Welcome back to Module 6 of Failover Clustering in Windows Server 2012 R2. I'm Simon, joined again by Eldon. In this module, we're going to take you through really two different types of design architectures to have a multi-site cluster. Now, when we use multi-site cluster, we use that term kind of loosely. Essentially, we're talking about having physical nodes in different physical locations. So we're going to start this module off by talking about how we provide this multi-site type of high availability with our Hyper-V replica. Secondly, we're going to be talking about how we provide this multi-site availability using multi-site failover clustering. So we'll kick it off first, talk a little bit about DR, Hyper-V replica, then really dive into this consideration about multi-site clustering. So first of all, what is high availability and how does that differ from disaster recovery? Well, with high availability, we're essentially allowing the VMs to stay online. We're moving them between different physical servers. But one thing that it really doesn't protect us against is if we lose that entire data center, things such as power outages, fires, other natural disasters, or even things where you have malicious humans doing things, such as killing power, or things such as attacks on a data center. So with all of these types of different catastrophic situations, we want to be resilient to that and allow you to keep your services and applications running by moving them to an entirely different data center. That's what disaster recovery is all about, is protecting us against losing this entire data center. So being able to shift the applications up, trying to minimize the downtime and minimize service interruption. So one of the top reasons why disaster recovery solutions fail. So everyone at home, play this game with me. See if you can think about naming them. Well, the third most common one that we hear is that failure detection itself failed. How you were supposed to trigger that the service crashed or the data center is offline didn't work. So no failover ever happens. Number two reason comes down to poor testing. People have made changes, people haven't tested those particular VMs, and when the disaster happens, things just didn't work as planned. But the number one problem, number one reason why these DR solutions fail is a dependence on people, a lack of automation. So with failover clustering, we're providing a highly available and automated disaster recovery solution as well, if you so desire. Now, when you kind of think about a real disaster, let's say there's an earthquake. You know, Eldon, you have three kids at home. If there's an earthquake in Seattle, are you going to run to the data center and live migrate virtual machines?
No.
No, you're a real person.
You are out of here. I'm out of here.
You're leaving. You're getting the dog, getting the family, getting them in the car, getting out of here. And that's the reality. When real disasters happen, people don't care about the data center anymore. That's bad for the business, but this is a true reality. So you really want to try to eliminate those single points of failure. And if you can, eliminate that human intervention so that you can ensure that you have a resilient application and people that aren't affected by the disaster, your customers in other parts of the country or world, they can continue using their services. Your business can continue to run and operate. So let's quickly look at the breadth of Microsoft disaster recovery solutions. First of all, we have a traditional failover cluster, what we've been talking about through most of the day, where we can move our virtual machines between the different nodes. On top of that, we can have our guest clusters, something that we covered in the last module, where we're virtualizing the application and providing high availability within the VMs. We then also have backup. Now, backup, it's kind of a cheap version of disaster recovery. Chances are you're going to lose data. Chances are it's going to take you a while to restore. But if you want to make sure that you can recover some data, it's a temporary solution. We have backup with Windows Server and also with Data Protection Manager, making sure that we can back up VMs, applications, hosts, clusters, things like that. We also now support backup to the cloud. And also disaster recovery to the cloud. So if you don't have that second data center or that second storage array somewhere, you can now actually use Microsoft Azure's data centers and do failover to those. We'll cover that in a little bit of detail at the end. We then also want to make sure that we have orchestrated recovery as well when we're doing this. Being able to go and do things such as replication, bring things online, make changes when they're appropriate. What we're really going to be focusing on, though, as part of this session, we're not going to be covering backup. We're not going to be covering the public cloud. We're going to be focused on these solutions that involve clustering. So the host clustering, multi-site clustering, and replication. So as you kind of look at choosing a disaster recovery solution, we're going to explore two options that involve clusters. We have traditional multi-site clustering, which has been around since Windows Server 2003. Is that right, Eldon?
Mm-hmm.
Where you can have multiple sites. And that's one massive cluster. Now, kind of the big difference of this. Actually, let me explain the other one. The second option is a Hyper-V replica. And this is where you'll have two clusters, one at each site, and data is being replicated between them. So first of all, you have kind of a high-level configuration. Do you have a single stretch cluster across both sites or two separate clusters at each site? Second consideration you have is, what amount of data am I willing to lose? Now, if you use a traditional multi-site cluster, you actually have to go well with a third-party replication vendor. A key requirement to disaster recovery is ensuring that you have the data in both locations. If all of your data is at your primary site and that's unavailable, it doesn't matter if the VMs move to the secondary site. If they don't have their virtual hard disks or their data, essentially, it's useless. So you want to make sure that the data is copied between both sites. Multi-site clustering allows you to use synchronous or asynchronous, which means that everything is guaranteed to be at both sites, or we push everything across at set intervals. Whereas the Hyper-V replica, it can only use that second option, where every 30 seconds, 5 minutes, or 15 minutes, we go and push the data across. So potentially, you could have some data loss. But one of the big things is the cost. If you're using that multi-site clustering solution and having to work with the third-party replication vendor, you need to go pay that third-party replication vendor. That's an additional solution, an additional integration point, an additional vendor that you need to interact with. On the other side, Hyper-V Replica is free, it's inbox, and it's included on all of the different versions of Windows Server that support Hyper-V, including the free Hyper-V server. Now, one of the most common questions we get is, well, what about DFSR? We've had this around for ages, at least a decade. Why can't I use this to go replicate my files? Well, the reason why is DFSR will only replicate once a file is closed. And so this is nice for things like Word documents, Excel, things where you're constantly doing edits, closing, then the replication happens. But if you kind of think about what happens with a virtual machine or a SQL database, we open the file, that virtual hard disk, and it's going to stay running for hopefully days, if not weeks, if not months. We don't purposely close that file, so replication never happens. And so for this reason, flat out DFSR not supported as a replication solution beyond what it's designed to do. Replicate files, office docs, kind of the information worker scenario. Let's talk about specifically Hyper-V Replica now. Hyper-V Replica essentially allows us to replicate between these different sites or within a data center between different racks. We usually consider having a primary site, a secondary site, and configuring a WAN link between them. Now, the main scenarios are replicating from your corporate office to your branch office, replicating from multiple branch offices to a single service provider, or we even support what we call extended replication, where we can do replication from a primary to a secondary and even a tertiary site. Now, one of the most common scenarios we hear for this third one is when we have metro clusters. A metro cluster is essentially when you have a multi-site cluster, but it's within a tight geographic area. One of the most common examples we use is the financial industry based in New York. They have their primary data center in Manhattan. They have their secondary data center across the Hudson over in Hoboken in New Jersey somewhere. So they're still very, very tight, maybe a few miles apart. Well, the challenge that you have with those metro clusters is if you have a regional power outage, you have a hurricane, things that have actually happened very recently in that area of the country, you could lose both sides of your cluster at once. But by having this third level of replication, this third site, we could do our metro cluster for faster failover and disaster recovery, and then we could go replicate to a different state or across the country or to a different country with that third replication so that you can still ensure that you don't have data loss or full business outage in case you lose both sites in that primary metro cluster. So what are the key features here? Well, we don't care what type of storage you're using. We are storage agnostic. We don't care what type of workload is running inside the VM. But the key point here is we are replicating virtual machines, specifically that virtual hard disk file. We're using this type of asynchronous replication where we make the changes at the first site and then every 30 seconds or 5 minutes or 15 minutes push it to the second site. Now this means that we have a low recovery point objective and a low recovery time objective. Now essentially what this means is there can be data loss that happens here. So got to be kind of careful here. Let's say I'm only replicating every 15 minutes. and I have a crash 10 minutes since I last replicated. Well, I could go and lose some data. So if you have some type of application that cannot afford any type of data loss, you're going to want to go with option two that Eldon will be talking about, a traditional multi-site cluster. Some other features of Hyper-V Replica. We could go do testing of that replication, plan failover, unplanned failover, test failovers. We can also create multiple replication points so we can go and recover a virtual hard disk to a different point in time. Now, as we start to think about security considerations, if you have a Hyper-V cluster, that cluster still needs to be domain joined, so it's still part of Active Directory. You can do Hyper-V Replica with workgroups if you set specific types of delegation, but there are several features that aren't supported if you do that. So in general, if you're an enterprise, we recommend making sure that it's domain joined. For authentication, we can use Kerberos-based authentication or certificate-based authentication. And we have specific firewall rules that are built in, the Hyper-V Replica, that you'll want to go and open up to ensure that this replication traffic can be sent through using either HTTP or HTTPS. Now, as you go and configure the replication, you get to configure these security settings, turn things on. One thing that we really aim to do with failover clustering is provide a consistent UI for the replication, whether you're doing that on a standalone host or in a cluster. And we'll go take a look at that shortly as well. As far as the different features within Hyper-V Replica, we could go monitor the health of replication itself. We could keep track of counters, such as how frequently has it replicated, when was the last replication, what's the amount of data that's being transferred. We could actually go and send initial replications over our WAN using physical media. So if I have a virtual machine that has a 100 gigabyte hard drive, something massive, I might not want to go replicate that over my WAN, but I can go put it on physical medium, send it to my other data center, and basically go and import that replica to the secondary site. Now, every time we do a replication, we're not copying all of that virtual hard disk. What actually happens is we keep track of the deltas or the changes, and we're just doing change level replication. So we're only replicating the changes for that virtual hard disk between the last time it was replicated and the current time. Some other features we have, again, this planned replication, pause in replication, view in replication information, and a whole lot of different types of testing scenarios. Now, what we really want to focus on is not make this a training about Hyper-V Replica. That's already available on the MVA, so if you go check out our other courses around server virtualization, we have an entire module specifically designed for Hyper-V Replica, general purpose. What we really want to focus on here is how it's different on a cluster. And this is the key thing to keep in mind when you're replicating on a cluster is it cannot replicate within a cluster. It has to replicate from the cluster itself to some other entity. That could be cluster to cluster, cluster to standalone, standalone to cluster, or if you want to do replica, standalone to standalone. But key thing again, you cannot replicate within the single cluster. Second thing here is we make the replication engine highly available. We figure if you put your VMs on a cluster, they're important VMs, you want to make sure that they run. And so if you're backing them up through Hyper-V Replica, we want to make sure that those replications are happening. So what we've done is we've created a new role on the failover cluster known as the Hyper-V Replica Broker, HVRB. And essentially, this is a highly available replication engine. Just like something else that runs on a cluster, one node will own it. If that node crashes, we'll go and fail over that replication engine to another node. So the replication is highly available, so long as that cluster stays online. Now, key thing again, I mentioned this earlier, really need to emphasize the point. Big difference because of this with multi-site clustering is multi-site clustering is a single cluster across multiple sites. With replica, you need one cluster on site A, one cluster on site B, because again, that replication cannot happen within a single cluster. When you go do a failover for your virtual machines, we actually have configuration options inside Hyper-V here that will actually allow you to go configure failover. So here you can see our failover using TCP/IP as one of the features available in our network adapter, so you can configure after failover. Here's how I want to go change my IP addresses. Now, as we start to think about really trying to scale up, You know, we have customers that say, I don't have a secondary site, or my secondary site can't support everything that my first site can have. So we wanted to make sure that we can take advantage of those Azure data centers and offer failover up to Microsoft Azure. So what we're able to do using Azure Site Recovery, we could go and essentially use Azure to go and connect to your first site or to your second site and manage that replication between them. Or we could go and replicate directly from my first site over to Azure. We can also replicate other types of virtualization solutions from one of Microsoft's recent acquisitions, InMage Scout. InMage Scout supports replication of ESX and VMware virtual machines as well. So we're trying to be heterogeneous, support all different types of replication here. Now, the advantage of using Microsoft Azure and this Azure Site Recovery, if you have the two data centers, is the management layer that it introduced. Now, if I just have my two sites and I've just manually configured replication between the two, I still need to go in and manually fail things over if I need to do a site failover, or I need to go write a script, and then I still got to control what happens after they fail over and start to come online on the other site. Do I want to bring my domain controllers on first, then line of business? So what we're able to do using Azure Site Recovery is create a concept known as a recovery plan. Within a recovery plan, we can essentially assign different types of VMs into groups, like my domain controllers, my line of business applications, my databases, and then we could go move those groups as a logical unit, bringing them on in specific orders and creating dependencies between them. Another advantage that Site Recovery has is, in many cases, if there's been a genuine disaster between sites, you may have lost some servers. Maybe you've lost your remote desktop gateway server and you can't actually RDP into that data center. Well, what Site Recovery does is it actually speaks using our APIs. So there's no dependency on remote desktop to go and initiate and trigger a failover. Site Recovery does that directly through APIs. So as long as we have some network connection that will support that communication, you're more likely to be resilient, more likely to have access, and be able to go move those apps between the sites. But what happens if you only have this single site, as many of our customers have? Well, our latest enhancement allows you to do failover directly to Azure itself. So rather than coordinating between two data centers that you own, you coordinate between your data center and the Microsoft Azure data center. Similar set of features, control, management, allowing you to kind of do these staggers, these ordered groups and different plans. And also, what's going to be coming in 2015 is supporting VMware replication up to Azure Site Recovery. So if you have a single data center running ESX with VMware, you can go fail that up to Microsoft Azure as well. So a very cool technology here, ensuring we support heterogeneity. Well, let me jump into my demo, and we'll actually walk through the process of creating a Hyper-V replica broker before we go turn it back over to Eldon to talk about multi-site clustering. All right, so I'm back in my failover cluster. We have my first virtual machine already running. And now I'm going to go select my roles, and I'm going to say configure a new role. Through our high availability wizard, you'll notice that there's a role listed here known as the Hyper-V replica broker. Now we get to specify a name for this. So since this is going to be a cluster object, it's going to have a CNO associated with it, so that we can manage it, use it as a cluster-aware entity. We're just going to validate that name is free, confirm the settings, and then we've gone and created this new role, this Hyper-V replica broker. This will take a minute to come online. Here we go. So it's now up and running. So this is our highly available replication engine. So we can now go and select replication settings. And if you've configured Hyper-V Replica on a standalone host, you're going to notice that these same settings are identical. Again, we've tried to have similarities between how you manage things in Hyper-V Manager versus how you manage things on top of the cluster. So you'll see this exposed here once this interface opens up. All right. So now we've got our Hyper-V Replica broker. We want to go turn this on. Let's use Kerberos, as that's available in my environment by default. And then we get to go specify which authentication or replication servers we're going to use. Now in this case, we'll keep it simple. I will allow replication from any authenticated server in my environment. But what you got to think about here is when a virtual machine replicates to this cluster, where am I going to put that VM? Well, keep in mind all those best practices about virtualizing on top of a cluster. Ideally, you want to use cluster shared volumes. Ideally, you want to go put that behind a scale-out file server as well. So be aware of that and do those best practices. So let's actually go ahead and we will go and specify our scale-out file server as well as the location that we're going to go and store these virtual machines. We'll click Apply. And then it pops this up, reminding me to go and open up a firewall setting. So one thing that I really like about Hyper-V Replica is how intuitive it is. It really kind of guides you in what you need to do. So let's go ahead, open up Windows Firewall. We want to allow an app through Firewall. And if we scroll down and take a look at our options here, you'll see that we have Hyper-V Replica through HTTP or HTTPS. We'll click OK. Now, I want to make sure that I turn this on across every single node in my cluster. I've already gone and done this on node 2 and node 3, so really this is only going to only need to be done on this first node here. So now that we've got our replica setting enabled, we'll actually go and configure replication for one of our VMs. So I select a VM that I created earlier, and I say go and enable replication. And this is going to be the same wizard that you see if you go and replicate a standalone virtual machine as well. You go specify the server that you're going to replicate it to. You specify how frequently you're doing the replication, recovery points, how you're doing the initial configuration, etc. Now, in this particular environment, I don't have my second replication server open, so we're not going to go end-to-end. But again, we're not really going to try to teach you all that you need to know about Hyper-V Replica. The focus here is specifically on how we go and do this using failover clustering. So with that, that's the end of our Hyper-V Replica broker. We've seen how to configure it. And I'm going to go turn it over to Eldon, and he's going to walk us through the ins and outs of multi-site clustering, which is where we have that single cluster stretched across multiple sites.
All right, thank you, Simon. So we're going to talk about multi-site clustering, sometimes referred to as stretch clusters. So Simon kind of talked on some of this a little bit. I'll just kind of read a little bit and I'll kind of move through this. So a stretch cluster, again, it protects from the big differentiator between a stretch cluster and Hyper-V Replica is really about, we talked about the RPOs and the RTOs, and it's really about what are your service level agreements, your SLAs that you have to achieve. So an RPO is the recovery point objective, which is how much data loss am I willing to sustain in the event of a failure. So let's say, for example, you're a stock trader, maybe you can't afford to lose any data, or maybe it's a file server for your marketing department with some PowerPoints. You know what, it's not that big of a deal if I lose 5 minutes of data, then maybe that's acceptable. Then you're just going to lose a little bit of data in the event of a true catastrophe. And so that's really kind of helping you pick between is Hyper-V Replica acceptable? Which it is for, and I think the way to think about it is your tier two deployments. Your tier two deployments, your file server for your marketing department, your home directories, those are things that you're going to want to protect with Hyper-V Replica. And it's going to deliver the RPOs that are acceptable to you. And if you need a higher RPO where you can't accept as much data loss, then getting into some of the higher end data replications, SAN-based replications that deliver synchronous replication may be what you need. The other aspect to think about, as Simon discussed a little bit, was about RTO, which is the recovery time objective. So it's a matter of, so the first part is how much data can I afford to lose in the event of a loss? And the second thing is how much time can I afford to lose in the event of a loss? And this is almost like a slider bar. So if you think about it, backup, so I think of kind of traditional backup and restore at the bottom of this kind of slider bar, at the far end of the slider bar, because maybe in the event that you lose a data center, to recover from tape, it might take you days. So your recovery time objective is days lost while you're in the data center restoring all this data from tape. Now, if you kind of move that up to Hyper-V Replica, you have a very good recovery time objective. But again, it is an automated failover. So that means that in the event of a catastrophe, that means that you're going to, automated means that there's going to be human decisions made. You're going to get together in a conference room. You're going to make some educated decisions. Someone's going to go pull the trigger. And you might have context of maybe, let's say, hours of downtime as you decide to fail over across the data centers. And then the kind of on the far end spectrum of that is if you want to reach even a smaller amount of RTO, recovery time objective. So in the event of a catastrophe that you lose a data center, that you will fail over within seconds to the data center, and there's no human decisions, it's automatic. So when you're thinking about these solutions, you kind of got, you know, from an RTO perspective, you got backup restore on the far end, you've got kind of Hyper-V replica in the middle, and then on the far end, you've got stretch clustering where it can deliver automatic failover instead of automatic and get that low RTO. Another aspect I want to talk about, as long as we're talking about disaster recovery, is about disaster, what we call disaster avoidance. So for example, in one of the recent hurricanes that hit the East Coast, one of the things that they were able to do was disaster avoidance. That means that they saw the weather reports, they saw that the hurricane was coming, and they actually proactively failed over from the primary data center to the disaster recovery data center just in case. And then the storm came and actually took out the primary data center, and they actually did that with zero downtime. So one of the beautiful things with Hyper-V Replica is that you can do disaster avoidance, actually zero downtime disaster avoidance, where you can fail over to that DR site with zero downtime and actually do disaster avoidance. So there's actually some beautiful things that you can do with Hyper-V Replica integrated with Azure Site Recovery to give you that automation. But again, a stretch cluster, a multi-site cluster, is where you really start thinking about how do I get that even smaller RTO for my tier one applications? How do I get that, you know, I have this mission critical infrastructure which needs to have that automatic failover in seconds of downtime in the event of a catastrophe. So when you start thinking about deploying a stretch cluster, you're going to have at least one node on each side. And the reality is that you're going to have really two or more nodes on each side. So let's think about this. When doing a site failover is moderately expensive, and by expensive I mean it's going to be time-consuming, and it you may it traditionally may be more involved when you fail over from one site to another one. So the reality is that in the event of a server loss, so let's say I have a server which fails, I want to do site local failover first. So you always want to kind of prefer site local failover before you go and do geo failover across locations or metro failover, which would be, so kind of the definition there is we like to think about is you have site local failover, I'm failing over for between server to server that are maybe in the same rack, and then you have metro failover, which is kind of failing over from a server which is in this data center to this server in this other data center, which is maybe just across the river, maybe a few miles away. And then kind of geo failovers when we think about failing over from like the East Coast to the West Coast. So failing over great distances. And usually when you, and then there's different replication types. We'll talk about that in a second. So you want at least two nodes in each site. So you do site local failover in the event of a server failure. And you really try to only do site failover in the event of a light of a, in the loss of a site. You're going to want to have resiliency in your network communication between the sites. So in the event that you have some WAN failures or instability between the sites, you're going to want to have some sort of resiliency in those WAN connections. And then you're going to need some sort of third-party data replication to achieve the failover. And the cluster management is ultimately identical. So let's look at creating a multi-site cluster. All right, so now we're going to go and create a multi-site cluster. So here I'm connected into my cluster that I had before. As you can see, this is a two-node cluster. So here I have my two nodes, which are up and running. And I'm actually going to go and add Simon's three nodes that are over actually in a different building than mine. So I'm going to go and add his three nodes.
Now, one important clarification. I just went and destroyed my cluster. So we're not adding one cluster to the other cluster. What we've done is we've taken that three-node cluster, broken it apart. We've got Eldon's existing two-node cluster, and then we're adding those three. So I guess just to clarify, we're not merging two clusters here. We're adding standalone host to an existing cluster.
So now if we look at the demo, I'm going to add, I've added Simon's three servers here, and I'm going to go hit next. And again, it's going to ask me if I want to run validate. Now normally, you want to run validate, and I really strongly recommend this. It's going to catch any misconfiguration or anything that's wrong, and it's something I really, anytime you're going to be doing a change like this, strongly recommend. But I'm wild and crazy, and I'm going to say no. And we're going to just try to add these three nodes to the cluster. So here's Simon's three nodes, and we're adding these into the cluster.
And I guess you can see in the background here, if you look under that node list, you can start to see them join here.
You can see that it has no vote, and there it is, it's joining, it got assigned a vote, and now it's moving on to the next one. So that one's fully up. In comes the next one. Again, it's joining, it's showing up in membership. It has not started and joined membership yet, so it doesn't have a vote yet.
Now, just going back to that validation here, what's kind of the overall best practices we have about when should you run validation? Like, what are the common types of changes you might make to the cluster which should justify someone running validation?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's a good chunk of it is about how paranoid do you want to be in the sense that how what sort of changes? And I think, you know, such as you add a new node, that's a pretty significant change. You're probably going to want to run validate when you do that. You could also do it when you, like, rev an HBA driver. You want to make sure things work. You add a new LUN. You're probably going to want to run validate against that new LUN to make sure it works. So I view it as based on the scope of change and then kind of your the criticality of the deployment. If you have a really mission-critical deployment, you're probably going to be a little more conservative, and you're going to want to run validate more often to verify the configuration. All right, so if we look at this, it is now joined. So here it says the three nodes have joined. I hit finish. And now you can see that I have my two servers, which were in my existing cluster, and Simon broke down his cluster, and he had three nodes. And they are all now here. So if I go and look at the networks on this, you will now see that I have multiple networks here. So you will see that I have one network, which was for on my cluster, the two networks. And now there's a third network. And so what's happened is that it's analyzed the physical NIC interfaces across the servers on Simon's three nodes and then created a cluster network associated with them. So now I actually have two networks. And if I look at them, you'll see Simon's is on one subnet because he's sitting over in one physical building.
So 10.1.21.
10.1.21. And if we go look at mine, I'm in 10.30. So we're actually in two different physical subnets, and we have these nodes which are joined as part of a cluster.
And I really like the fact there was no additional configuration. It really was, add these nodes, we will go figure out how to go route, manage all of that traffic behind the scenes.
Yep, exactly. All right, so let me flip back to the slides. And let's talk about storage considerations when doing a multi-site cluster. So storage considerations. So one of the things about a multi-site cluster is that you're going to have servers which are located in different physical buildings. And what's different, and traditionally with a cluster, you have shared storage between the two, and they're both of the servers are pointed at the same piece of storage. Now, in a multi-site cluster, that's a giant single point of failure, right? You don't want to have that you have one storage in one building and the other server's pointing at it because in the event that you lose this data center, you don't want to lose the compute and the storage together. So that means that you need to have some redundancy in the storage. That means having storage in both locations and then having data replication between the two. So that's one of the big characteristic differences between a single-site cluster with shared storage and one piece of storage versus a multi-site cluster which has two compute in different buildings with their own independent set of storage. So there's no real shared disk. You're really flipping over from one replicated piece of storage to another piece of replicated storage. So you need to have some sort of data replication mechanism between the two. So there's different types of data replication that you can do. I'm going to cover just some real simple basics. So the first one is synchronous. So synchronous means that I've got a VM. It goes and does a write request. It's going to write it to the local storage. Then it's going to replicate it off to the secondary storage. The secondary storage will acknowledge back to the primary. And then once that complete, it will acknowledge back up to the virtual machine. So the key point here is that I have to actually write the data at both the primary and the remote data center before the app acknowledges back. Now, doing that gives you wonderful data consistency guarantees and zero data loss, right? Because you've actually committed the data to both sites before the VM is acknowledged and allowed to move forward. There's a drawback to that, which is performance. If the app can't move, if the VM can't move forward until the write is committed to both locally and across to the remote data center, that's going to have a performance cost. So it's actually going to slow down your virtual machine. So synchronous replication, great for zero data loss, has some performance implications. So you need to think about that. And you can mitigate some of these things by how fat of a pipe are you going to have between the primary and data center, but that equals cost. So it's really a matter of how much money are you willing to throw at it to get the fatter pipe, which will then reduce the latency and give you the higher bandwidth so that you don't have the performance impact. Now, to mitigate this, the other alternative is to do asynchronous replication. So asynchronous replication basically involves saying, I got the virtual machine up and running, it writes to the local storage, and then the storage immediately responds back and says, ACK, and it acks the write and allows the VM to move forward. So it has no performance implications. It is exactly the same as just writing to local storage. Then what happens is that later on, the array will then replicate it off to the in an asynchronous fashion in a, to the secondary storage. So VM writes, immediate ACK, VM moves forward, and then later on in the background, the storage array is replicating off to the secondary DR site. So the pro of this, obviously, no perf impact. So that's the beauty of asynchronous replication. But there's an RPO impact. So from a recovery point objective of how much data am I going to lose? You're going to lose data, right? Because if you're committing a write and boom, that data's gone, and you lose that data center before it's acknowledged it off to the other secondary site, you do have data loss. So it's a matter of how much data loss are you willing to incur with an asynchronous replication solution. So here, this is just actually what I was just covering. So again, synchronous, no data loss, but you got to throw some money at it. You got to have that high bandwidth. You got to have that low latency. You can't stretch it as far. It's usually good for a metro scenario, going across the river, going a couple miles. And there's impact to the application. On asynchronous, on the other side, again, it can keep up. It can stretch over longer distances. If you're going to be going a geo scenario across the East Coast to West Coast from North America to Europe, you're probably going to want to do async because it can go over the greater distances. And there's no real impact to the performance of the application, but there is an RPO impact. RPO cannot be achieved of zero with asynchronous replication. Another thing to think about with cluster shared volumes. So cluster shared volumes is a cluster file system, and it enables all nodes to have access to the disk. But the problem here is that on a stretch cluster, you don't have one disk. It's not multiple servers simultaneously accessing a single disk. You actually have some servers attached to one storage array and another set of servers attached to another storage array. And the state of that replica is not going to be writable. So it's usually in like a read-only mode on that secondary site. So there are some considerations with that in the sense that not all nodes have access to the storage. The answer is go talk to your storage vendor. Some storage vendors with their replication solutions do integrate and work with cluster shared volumes, and some don't. So if you want to use cluster shared volumes and you're doing Hyper-V, you're probably going to do it. Go talk to your storage vendor because some may work and some won't. So just be aware of that. So now, let's go talk about some of the storage considerations, let's talk about networking considerations. So there's kind of two ways to deploy a multi-site cluster. So there's kind of the way that we did it a decade ago, which was that customers used to have to stretch VLANs across sites, right? And that you would have to stretch that 10.10 subnet across site A to across the site B. Networking administrators really, really hated this. And that's why in Windows 2008, we introduced the capability to have nodes which resided in dissimilar subnets. And that's what you saw Simon and I demo a second ago, was actually, we actually had a multi-site cluster of five nodes with three nodes on one site and one building here at Microsoft and two in another building on totally different subnets, and we joined them into a cluster. And that's kind of what the dissimilar subnet support is, and we added that in 2008 to be able to fail over across subnets. So when stretching clusters, what are some of the considerations you might want to think about? When you're going over greater distances, it means more latency. And if you remember from the networking module, one of the single greatest things clustering of considerations is about quality of service and latency. And whether that be heartbeat networking, intra-cluster communication, or CSV, latency is the single biggest consideration. So that's what you need to think about when you're stretching your clusters. With that, you may actually want to increase some of the heartbeating threshold. So by default, they're set at like once a second we're sending heartbeats, and if you drop five heartbeats, it's considered a node down. In a multi-site stretch cluster, you probably want to up that a little bit. I'd probably increase that to like 20. So maybe you'll have, I would set the cross subnet threshold to 20 so that you can drop 20 heartbeats. And you may even go higher depending on what sort of latency.
Distance, things like that. There's a lot of, I guess, environmental variables that could impact that. So definitely test.
Yeah,
that's the key thing for that.
Many variables. And the delay is kind of designed that you have less than 500 milliseconds of latency. So if you have more than 500 milliseconds of latency, you may want to go increase the same subnet delay. So that's another attribute thing. But that's the only time I would touch the same subnet delay. I would leave same subnet delay at 1 second unless you have more than 500 milliseconds of latency, and then just go crank up cross subnet threshold to 20. If your data centers are across an insecure WAN, so by default, all intra-cluster communication is signed. But you can also enable it and set it to encrypted. There is a little bit of a performance impact. That's why we don't set it by default. But if you're going to stretch clusters across sites across an insecure WAN, then you probably want to enable the encrypted communication between the nodes in the cluster. But normally I wouldn't touch this unless you have an unsecure WAN connection. So let's talk a little bit about configuring resources in a multi-subnet configuration.
Well, first, I guess, what's this whole dependency thing here? I saw it in the cluster UI, but like, what do we really use that for?
So with the network, okay, so let's talk about, so dependencies kind of affect two things. So the first thing is they affect start ordering. So imagine that when you're starting up a virtual, let's say a SQL instance, first you want the file system and the disk to be mounted. You want the disk to come on, have ownership. You want the file system to be mounted. You want to have the IP address resources it'll be connected to, the network name to be bound on the system. Once all of the infrastructure is there, then you want to go start SQL, but not before then. You want to wait until you have all the infrastructure up and running. And that's what dependencies do, is they give you start ordering. So ensuring this starts before this, and it doesn't start until that's done, and then the next thing, and the next. So, and the same thing when you shut down. So when you shut down, you want to rip that disk out from under SQL and cause corruption. You want to make sure the database is completely gracefully shut down or the virtual machine, then we remove the disk underneath it.
Now, if you had a dependency on, let's say, that a disk needs to come online and an IP address needs to come online, would that be an and dependency? I just see here on the screen we talk about all dependencies, but we have and dependencies as well, right?
Yep. So we have and dependencies, which say this and this need to come online. And then what an or dependency is, either this one or that one. And that really applies. So the next thing that dependencies do is around network name resources. So it defines what is the name which is registered in DNS. So from a network name resource, it will actually look at its dependent resource at the IP address associated with it, and then it will register in DNS the IP address which it's dependent on, which is in an online state. So let's talk about how failover works in a multi-site cluster. So you have a single network name resource, let's call it foo, and then you will have two IP address resources. So with Simon's, what was it? It was
10.121
and
you 10.130, I think.
Yeah, 10.130. So you actually have two different subnets. So what you'll do is you'll create an IP address for each subnet. And what happens is that when the group is online on one of my nodes, the IP address resource associated with that subnet will come online, and since there's no IP address associated with the other subnet, with Simon's, they won't come online. So the one comes online, the network name goes and registers in DNS that IP address resource that came online. Then when you fail over to the other side, what's going to happen is the IP address associated with my subnet in my building cannot come online because there's no IP valid range there. Then the other one comes online. So that's that or. It's saying, hey, this one or this one, and the reality is only one's going to come online because it's only one that's valid for that subnet range.
Now, what happens if I accidentally configured this with an and dependency? I said both of these need to come online. Would that mean that neither's going to come online? This resource won't come online, right?
No, yeah, you're right. Exactly right. So then it won't come online. Neither one will come online because it's saying that in order for the network name resource to come online, IP address A and B have to come online, but they can't because we're in different servers in different buildings, and they're two different, valid for two different subnets.
And these are the only logical operators we have. It's or and. Okay.
Or and, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Now, there is a configuration setting you can set for this. So the default behavior is we only register the IPs that come online. There is something called register all IP providers. And what that does is it says, hey, register all the IPs, whether they came online or not. And so here's the difference. So what happens is that when net name comes online, IP address A comes online, registers in DNS the IP address for A. When a client goes to connect, they go get the IP, they get the address for A returned to them, and then they go and resolve to the IP and then go and connect to it. And they can't, but when you have register all IP providers, what that's saying is that I have logic in my app that I can handle getting multiple IP addresses returned to me, and I have retry logic that I'll try this one. If it doesn't work, I'll try that one. Let me get into this some more. I'm doing a lot of hand waving, and I actually have some diagrams. So let's talk about how this works. So here I have a diagram. I have two nodes and dissimilar subnets. I've got one node in site A on 10.10, and I've So what happens is that the I come online and it's going to register in the DNS server an address of 1.1. Oops, what did I do? I went the wrong way. Oop. So then that DNS record is going to have to be replicated. Let's say you have an 80 integrated DNS zone. It's going to have to replicate to all the DNS servers. And then when a client goes to query and try to connect to that file share, they're going to get the IP address return 10.10. Now, what's going to happen is that when I go to failover to Simon's node in 20.20 in site B, it's going to have to go update that DNS record. So that DNS record now 20.20 is registered with the DNS server. That DNS record is going to have to replicate with all the DNS servers. And then the client is going to have to obtain that DNS record, updated DNS record. Now, there's some timeouts here. So you get these DNS servers, and if they're in different locations, the default DNS replication time is 15 minutes. Now, the client also has a timeout, which is 20 minutes. He's not going to go and try to get a new DNS record unless 20 minutes has expired. So the reality is if I do a cross-subnet failover, I'm looking at potentially worst-case scenario, 20 minutes of downtime.
Now, is there any difference if I'm using a static IP address? So I got a single subnet, or sorry, multiple subnets. If I'm using a static IP address versus if I'm using DHCP?
It's going to be the same. You're still going to be changing the IP, which is changing the DNS record, which is going to then have to replicate all the DNS servers.
Get over to the client eventually.
The client will have to, yeah.
So what are some of the different ways that we can make this failover go faster?
Yeah, so there's ways to mitigate this. So by default, just think of it as your worst case scenario is your RTO is going to be 20 minutes on a cross subnet failover. So there's a way to mitigate this. So the first one is what I was talking about when we first do, when you think about stretch clusters, is site local failover. So in the event of a server failure, so maybe you have different SLAs. You have one SLA for a server failure, and you have another SLA for a data center failure. And usually most customers do, that if I lose a server, I need to recover in seconds. But if I lose a data center, maybe it's okay to lose it's okay if it's down for an hour. So the first thing is to scale up the number of nodes on each site, so you can do site local failover in the event of a server failure. And then you have a different SLA for cross subnet. Maybe 20 minutes is okay. The next one is the stretch VLANs. That's the old 2003 answer. Network admins are probably cursing and throwing tomatoes at their screens right now. But that's another way to mitigate this, is you can stretch VLAN across sites. And that way, when you do a failover, that IP doesn't change, right? It's still in the 10.10 subnet. I don't have to update those DNS records. I don't have to replicate it. I don't have to worry about the clients.
Now, what happens to me as a client, though? So if I'm originally using site A, I'm connected, suddenly there's a crash. How long is it going to take for me to reconnect to that virtual machine, even though I'm still on the same subnet? Will it just be recovery until that VM comes back online, essentially, on the second site?
The VM will come up, it'll start, it'll be accessible. If you're in a local subnet, you'll be able to get to it. So if you had maybe, so that's another good mitigation that if you, let's say it's an infrastructure server. So let's say you have a three-tier web app that is all running on top of the same private cloud. If they're in the same subnet, they're going to be able to talk to each other. The VMs are going to come up, they're going to start, but people on remote subnets won't be able to get to it. That's the impact. So there's another way to mitigate this, which is using networking devices. So you can use like Cisco. I've got a link to their solution. And effectively what they're doing is they're abstracting it. So even though the nodes are in dissimilar subnets, 10.10 is registering with the network device. And the network device in turn is turning around and representing it as 30.30 out to the DNS server. So then on the event of a failover, the cluster IP will actually change, but it will actually, and the network device will actually remap it. So 30.30 is now pointing to 20.20, and the DNS records and the clients never have to change. So that's another way to mitigate this. A fourth way to mitigate this is that there's some application, I talked about this register all IP providers setting. And so what that does is register all the IPs. But the dependence there is on the app. The app has to have the retry logic to get multiple DNS records returned, and that they have to have the logic to know I have multiple records and dealing with that, and then have retry logic that I'm going to go try these three addresses that got returned to me. If one fails, I'm going to try the other one. So they have to have the retry logic. So that's another way. And there's yet another mitigation, which is you can reduce the host record TTL. So by default, There's 20
TTL, time to live.
Yes.
So how long that host record will be around before it expires and you grab a new one, right?
Yep, from the client. So for the client by default is going to wait 20 minutes before it goes and tries to get a new DNS record. You can reduce that. So instead of 20, you can set it to 10 minutes. Now, the drawback of that is that your DNS clients are going to go start pounding your DNS server harder. They're going to be, every 10 minutes, they're going to be going to refresh their records, which is going to generate a little more strain on your DNS server. So depending on how many clients, maybe if you're just having like a few infrastructure servers, it's no big deal, but maybe you have 10,000 clients connecting to it, that's probably going to not be a good idea.
And I think there's some different best practices for different types of application service as well. At least in the past with Exchange, if you're doing all types of Exchange, they would recommend reducing that to 5 minutes or 600 seconds just so you have a failover, things will come on faster. But again, check the latest guides based on which version of SQL, Exchange, or whatever other application you're using.
Yeah, good point. So SQL supports registrar IP providers. So if you're doing SQL, you can use registrar IP providers to have fast failover. If you're doing Exchange, you want to reduce the host record TTL to 5 minutes. Another thing is if you're using virtual machines, you can actually use network virtualization to completely abstract the subnet. So when a VM fails over from one subnet to another one, you don't have to reconfigure the OS. So from a client perspective, you're still connecting to a VM on the same IP. So with Hyper-V, there's actually a great solution as well. With that, let's now go talk about Quorum on a multi-site cluster.
Now, just as a quick reminder, Quorum is that membership model that we looked at earlier. You know, us making sure that we have the correct number of votes. And we did talk about a couple of multi-site scenarios earlier. I think we're really just going to kind of refocus it and offer some of the best practices now that we're really focused on the multi-site.
Yep. So the first thing is that when you're configuring your clusters, you want to configure a witness. Now, with a multi-site cluster, you really want to have that witness be in a third location. And to do that, you're not going to have your storage be off in a third location, but you want to have an SMB share, an SMB file share off in some remote third location so it can be a file share witness. So this is really the point, the decision maker when there's two sites and who should stay up and who should drop out. And I'll walk through those scenarios in a second. Actually, let me go to them right now. So let's kind of talk about this. So here is so the goal here is that I've got, in site A, I've got two nodes, in site B, I've got two nodes. So those are two votes and two votes, that's four votes, and then I have a witness, that's five votes. So I need 3 out of 5 votes for the cluster to stay up. So with this solution, if let's say node 1 and 2, site 1 crashed, with node 3 I have a vote, node 4 I have a vote, and the witness I have a vote, that's 3 out of 5, the cluster stays up. If, for example, the witness were to die, then I have node 1, node 2, node 3, node 4 up, cluster stays up. So the beauty here is that the cluster is resilient to the loss of any one site, and it will automatically recover. So that's one of the beauty things, is you want to have your votes equal on each side and each site, and you want to have that witness be in a third site, which is that kind of that watchful eye between these two, which is going to see when these two can't talk to each other, who should stay up and who should drop out, and making your DR solution completely automatic and resilient to one site failure. Okay, so let's kind of walk back here for a second. So with the file share witness, you want to put that in a third site, like I kind of showed you before. And you don't have to worry about the networking. There's no real networking considerations to the file share witness. The use of the file share is very infrequent, so you don't need to worry about bandwidth. The most important characteristic is latency, but it's more that the latency is equal. So it's actually a timing-based algorithm in how node 1 and 2 will go fight for the file share witness. And it kind of doesn't matter what the latency is. It just matters that each site kind of has equal latency. And in the worst-case scenario is that let's say that there's a split between the two sites and both sites try to go fight for the file share witness, all that's going to happen is that one side will win the file share witness and stay up, and the other one will shut down. So the cluster will survive, but in general, you normally want your primary data center to win, and you want your secondary data center to shut down. So that's just the biggest consideration. So there's different ways to configure how you're doing your votes. Again, the optimal way is you want to have even votes with a third site, but you can also, and that will give you the automatic failover, you also can configure clustering to only do manual failover. So it depends on who you talk to. Some customers I go talk to, they're going to say, You know what? No, I want manual failover. When we have a catastrophe, we're going to have a meeting. We're going to have a discussion. We're going to decide what we want to do in an educated way, and then we're going to invoke our DR plans. And that's great. We can do that. You can configure a stretch cluster to only invoke failover when invoked manually. We can also, if you want to up your SLAs, we can also do automatic failover. So you can configure this however you want. So here you can see that if this node goes down, this site goes down, then it's talking about that it would fail the other one. Now the other attribute, a new aspect that we introduced in Windows Server 2012 R2, is what happens in the event that you don't have a third data center and you only have two sites and you have equal votes on both sides and you have a split between the two data centers. We wanted to be able to solve this scenario. So what's going to happen is that if we have a simultaneous 50% loss of nodes in the cluster, we're going to elect one side to win. And we have a property that you can set that will allow you to control which side that is. And you're going to want to set that to a node which is on your primary data center. So that's kind of the way to think about this. You don't have a third site. You are only going to do with even nodes. What you're going to want to do is an even number of nodes on each side and then configure the primary data center with this property so that it wins in the event of an even split between the two. So forcing quorum. So if you want to do manual failover only, that would be invoked by using the switch to start the cluster service called force quorum. So let's say, for example, you may stack the number of votes uneven. So in your primary data center, like Simon and mine's cluster, you have three servers in one location and two in the other. Well, in the event that there's a site loss of the primary data center, my cluster will never take over automatically because it's only got two nodes and two votes and that's it. So that means that my cluster will never win. In order to form, so what's going to happen that is that if the primary data center goes down, you're going to have your meeting, you're going to have your discussion, we're going to invoke the DR plans, we're going to bring up the DR site, and that would involve going over and running the switch saying force quorum, which means you don't have a majority of votes, but I want the cluster to start anyway. This is my, and you're kind of invoking your DR plans, and that would be effectively running this PowerShell commandlet. And that would force that side to start the virtual machines and get the cluster up and running. And so here's kind of how that would work. So if you look at, here's a situation where I never want automatic failover. Think about this. So on site one and nodes one and two, they have a vote. On nodes three and four, you can manually configure whether nodes have votes or not. We talked about in the quorum section. So we've actually dropped the vote. So nodes three and four don't have a vote. That means the DR site will never be able to take over automatically. So in the event of a failure of the DR site, the primary site will always survive, right? So you got three votes, one, two, and the witness. DR site goes down, primary always survives. No effect on quorum. But in the event that I were to lose my primary site, the DR site would never take over because it wouldn't have enough votes.
So I got a scenario for you here. So let's say that I have that three-node configuration, my data center, primary, two-node, your data center. Mine's down. So we go and force quorum. We're less than majority, so quorum is forced. I suddenly get a node back. I'm no longer out of force quorum. I have majority again.
Yep.
What happens if I lose that site again? Do I maintain that force quorum, or has force quorum dropped and I would need to go kick it off again?
That's a great question. So let's talk about kind of how dynamic quorum works with 2012 R2. So what's going to happen is you got two nodes, you force quorum, then another node comes up on your site. Now you're above majority. You're going to drop out of force quorum mode and you're in normal quorum mode.
So I would be reset back to normal.
Yeah, you can reset back to normal, but you have three votes. So what's going to happen now is the quorum will be recalculated for three. So you need a majority of three. So now if this node crashed, you would still survive because you'd have two out of three. So does that make sense?
That does.
So you've gone from five votes, you know, and then two were down, and then you were down to one, and then you have a majority of three. So
great.
Almost seems like a whiteboard. So so just kind of a recap of some of the different disaster recovery solutions. So again, multi-site clusters today with 2012 R2 do require third-party replication. That could be hardware-based replication. There's many solutions out there. Every single SAN vendor produces a hardware-based replication. Every single one of them integrates with failover clustering and works to provide an end-to-end solution. There's also software-based replication solutions out there that do volume-level replication. And there's also application-level. So you could do an Exchange DAG and actually replicate it across. You could do a SQL always-on availability group and do replication, do a stretch cluster across sites using SQL AGs and achieve disaster recovery and data replication. So just things to think about. All right, so let's go and actually configure a FileShare witness. Let me show you what that looks like.
So while Alden switches over again, I just want to remind you that FileShare witness, one of the quorum options. So you're going to actually see us go through that quorum wizard that I kind of walked you through briefly in the beginning. And let's go ahead and do it and configure that share.
All right. So if you go into, let's see, where is our quorum?
There'll be more actions.
Under more actions, quorum configuration settings. And then here I can go and I can select the quorum witness. So I have my choice of I can configure a disk witness, which is the default, or I can configure a file share witness. And I also can configure no witness if I wish. So here then I can actually go and configure. Let's see if I remember. I'm actually going to stick this on, let's see if this works.
So you actually stuck that vote on one of your disks that would be local, right?
Yes.
So that's going to not be a best practice in real world. You would want to go place that at a remote site. But
yes.
The point here was that we've got the file share. And
yes,
that's how
I just wanted
that.
To show you it working. So
yeah.
I just did something you totally not should do. So what you'll see here is that now in my quorum group, I used to have a disk witness, but now you'll see I have the file share witness. You'll actually see it points at Elden Cscale file server of my VMs. So I just did two terribly horrible things there. One, I configured the file share witness on the same cluster. That's a total no-no because you want to have that be in a third location. The second thing I did is I stuck it. I remember I talked about earlier, you want to have a dedicated share for your Scala file server. You want to have a dedicated share for your file share witness. You don't want to share it. So I just stuck it in the same share that I had your VMs configured a few minutes ago. But I just did it for the sake of the demo here. But two big no-nos, don't do that.
Sake of the demo, it does work.
It does work great. So I just did it for the sake of the demo so you could see it in action.
All right. Thanks, Eldon. Well, this wraps up module number 6. Hope you learned a lot about these different multi-site cluster options. And again, remember that big difference, right? Replication, two clusters, one at each site. Multi-site cluster, that single cluster spanning both of them. So based on your recovery time objective, recovery point objective, and a lot of other considerations, you'll be able to find a solution that works for you. All right, well, we're going to take a short break, and we will be right back to take a look at advanced cluster management and troubleshooting.